So what I want to talk about this evening is the anima mundi, the soul of the world. And actually, I don't just want to talk about the anima mundi. I want to see if we can invoke her presence, this living spirit of creation, this really divine consciousness within matter. I will begin by just giving a little history of the anima mundi in our Western culture. In the East, it is really very evident, like in Taoism, which is really a constant relationship to that living spirit in nature, in which one aligns one's whole life, one's whole way of being, one's whole understanding of life in relationship to this living spirit. The Tao, it's the same. It is the divine within creation. In the West, we have a kind of more conceptual understanding of it. And this is really the Western tradition of what we now call the Gaia principle, the understanding that the earth is a living being. And all I would add at the beginning to, in order to understand this, in order to relate to this, is that it is a living spiritual being. And just as we are a physical body with a soul, so is the world a physical body with a soul. And that soul is its spiritual essence. And as far as I can understand, unless you make a relationship to the soul of creation, to the anima mundi, you are just scratching the surface of life. Just as if somebody relates to you purely physically, they are just scratching your surface. They are not relating to you as a living, breathing, spiritual being, as a soul incarnate in this world. So one can go back, for example, to Plato, who understood the cosmos is a single living creature which contains all living creatures within it. So that's from the very origins of our Western civilization, this deep understanding that the earth is a living spiritual being. And the alchemists also, who regarded the world soul as a pure ethereal spirit diffused throughout all nature, the divine essence which embraces and energizes all life in the universe. So it is this living spiritual, not just principle, but substance within creation. And one of the great tragedies, if you like, in our Western culture was that this tradition was, in a way, exorcised by the Catholic Church. It was there in the very early days, it was there in the Gnostics in some of their teachings, and it reappeared for brief moments throughout the history of the West. There was this beautiful expression of it in the Gothic movement in the 12th and 13th centuries, and those of you who have been to the great Gothic cathedrals in Europe, like Chartres, you will see that the cathedral itself is like a tree, and in the sculptures and in the stained glass windows are all of the aspects of creation. There aren't just saints there, there are also living creatures, and the whole, in a way, esoteric design behind it is all of creation is contained within this geometric forms that reflect the divine ordering principle within creation. And if you were a medieval, not scholar, but if you were really interested in the depths of the spiritual understanding in the medieval time, you would explore that relationship, that understanding of that divine ordering principle within creation that was expressed in a way in a microcosm in the Gothic cathedrals. And it lasted for a while, like many spiritual flowerings that come in a way from the soul of the world. And one of course the interesting things is that Chartres Cathedral, which was the ideal Gothic cathedral, there was an esoteric school at Chartres, as many of you know, is actually built on a site sacred to the Black Madonna, which is again the earth spirit, the feminine divine earth spirit that gave birth to this understanding of the mystery of matter, of the divine expressing itself within creation. And it was there for a while, but then part of the patriarchal, if you like, oppression of the church was to split heaven and earth. And God is in heaven, and on earth, everything is sinful. And there was, of course, no understanding of the divine feminine of Sophia and that divine principle within creation. The earth was seen as a dark prison that trapped the soul of man rather than a place of divine expression. And so after the 12th, 13th century, this flowering, it got lost again. But like many true spiritual understandings, it's like a stream that goes underground, and then it reappeared in the Renaissance, which of course went back to Plato, back to the sacred teachings of Greece and further east. And in fact, as some of you know, there is a tradition that the whole of the Renaissance was actually started by a master who came from Constantinople on a donkey to northern Italy. And there he founded the esoteric school that Michelangelo, Leonardo, and others attended. And he brought with him this esoteric knowledge of the divine within creation, how that works, how she manifests herself, how she holds the divine proportions. And you see that, for example, in Leonardo's Man, in which heaven and earth are brought together, and the whole esoteric understanding of that. In the Renaissance, the world soul animated and formed nature according to divine proportions. And once again, the garden of the world was again enchanted with magical powers and transcendent meaning, implicit in every part of nature. This was the wonderful relationship in the Renaissance between the imagination and the creative principle in life. And there was this extraordinary flowering that really came from the divine feminine within the imagination, within life, and it was celebrated. And once again, the garden of the soul was here in this world. It wasn't just after you died in heaven, in paradise. It was here in the art that the Renaissance masters created. And this is why, for some of us, the Renaissance touches the soul now so deeply, and why there has been a kind of revival of understanding of what happened in the Renaissance, because it had to do with the divine feminine and the divine feminine within life, and that really it is an expression of the anima mundi. She once again expressed herself in the West in this beautiful flowering that, say, touches us very much. But then, of course, the church repressed it again. And sometimes quite brutally in the history of the church. And the only tradition that was really left carrying that after the tradition of sacred geometry got lost was the alchemical tradition, which Jung in the last century rediscovered for us. And in the alchemical tradition, the anima mundi is the divine spark in matter. And while the church looked upwards towards heaven, towards the ethereal world, the alchemists looked into matter. And part of their whole work was how to liberate this spark within matter, how to liberate the light hidden within matter, which is the secret of creation, this divine spark that is in every cell of creation. And really the mystery of turning lead into gold is revealing what is hidden within the darkness of matter. And so they, in a way, kept alive in this underground stream this principle of the anima mundi, of the soul of the world. They understood that there is a direct relationship between our soul, our individual soul, and the soul of the world. In fact, our individual soul is a spark in the anima mundi, is a spark in the soul of the world. It is not just our own individual soul, it is part of the soul of the world, it is a spark of light. And one of the great tragedies, if you like, which Jung expressed, was when he said, when we forgot that, when we forgot, man ceased to be the microcosm, and his anima or soul is no longer the consubstantial scintilla or spark of the anima mundi, the world soul. In a way, with rationalism, we forgot our place in the world. We forgot that our soul, this spark within us, has a direct relationship to the soul of the world. And I think out of that came, in a way, a lot of the impoverishment, soul impoverishment that we have today. Because once we lose that relationship to the divine within matter, within creation, once we say the divine is only in heaven or can only be found in deep meditation, if you're a yogi, we've lost something fundamental. And we've lost it both for ourselves and also for the anima mundi, for the soul of the world. If you like, humanity became more and more separated or veiled itself more and more from the soul of creation. Now, as many of you know, if you separate yourself from the light of your own soul, your life becomes darker and darker. It becomes more and more meaningless. And people would say that's one of the many of the reasons there is so much addiction in our Western culture. Because we have lost anything that nourishes us, so we get addicted, whether to drugs or sex or consumerism, shopping, whatever it is, because there is nothing that nourishes us. We have lost this relationship to what is present within creation, to the soul of creation. We have lost relationship to our own soul and to the soul of creation. And just to complete this kind of picture, I want to explain something that Jung understood, which has to do with the light of the divine. And this is very important, because the light of the divine has two qualities. And one is what is traditionally known as the Lumen Dei, the light of God. And it is really the divine light of one's higher self. It is a very, very beautiful light. It is very clear, it is very simple, it just is. It's the light of God as you can see it as a human being. Of course, the real light of God you cannot see, you become blinded by it. It is said he has 70,000 veils of light and 70,000 veils of darkness to separate us from experiencing the true light of the divine. But there is this Lumen Dei that we have within us, our divine light. And when you pray towards God, your light rises up to God. When you really pray, when you really pray to God, there is a light, there is a spark. You can see it from, in a way, outer space, from the human being, from the heart of the human being that goes to God. It's very beautiful. And if you go into deep meditation, like a yogi, you go into deep meditation, you discover that divine light within you. Very, very pure. I think it's called the diamond light in Buddhism. It's very, very like a diamond. Very clear, very pure, very beautiful. But that is only half of the way the divine expresses itself. And the other aspect is what Jung found in alchemy called the lumen naturae, the light within nature, the divine light within nature. And if you like, the Lumen Dei, this clear light, is the masculine expression of the divine, while the Lumen Naturae is the more feminine. It is the light in nature, the light that is present. And what is interesting is, as a culture, we have completely forgotten how to relate to that. I think a lot of traditional cultures, their rituals, whether in dance or song, were a way of being with that light in nature. Through that light, for example, you can speak to the soul of an animal. You can speak to the soul of a mountain. You can speak to the soul of a tree. It is working with the divine within creation. And in previous cultures, you wouldn't try to live without that light. How would you know what to do? How would you know where to hunt? How would you know about the healing properties of herbs? What is poisonous? What heals what ailments? The light, it was this communication of light with light. It was when the world was alive. You know, we have forgotten the world is alive. I had a beautiful experience the other day. It really moved me. Somehow I was taken back. I was trying to understand something, and I was taken back to how things were in the early days, before this cloud of forgetfulness came. And I was walking along a path, and I suddenly realized in those days, the path told you where it was going. I hadn't realized that before. I had read about the Aboriginal time when there were these song lines that guided the Aboriginals across the desert, and they followed the song lines. But I never realized that a path could actually speak to you and tell you where it is going. It is interesting because you can see it is like echoed a bit in Tolkien, in some of the songs in Tolkien, because he had access to those ancient memories. You know, he was a medieval English scholar, and he knew those stories that came from the very early times. When the path comes to meet you and it tells you beyond what hills it will take you. And it is this very different relationship of light to light that is very sacred. In a way, it is learning how to walk, how to live in a sacred manner, because it is respecting the divine within creation. And this has really been, in the West, it has been erased from our collective consciousness. And then, of course, in this country, there was this terrible tragedy because they erased it. They just killed off all the people who held that understanding. I mean, quite brutally. And didn't even allow their language to be spoken. That sacred language, that understanding of how to talk to the magic that is within creation. This relationship of light to light. This is, in a way, what the alchemists were doing in their crucibles is what many native cultures did in their daily life, talking to the light in nature, whether you call it the Great Spirit, it is the same. It is this living divine principle within creation. And I am completely convinced that we cannot solve the problems in the world, the ecological problems, for example, without invoking this light, this magic, this wisdom, this knowledge, this presence within nature. How can you heal yourself if you treat yourself just as a physical body? I mean, yes, Western medicine does that, and for some things it's good, like takes out the appendix. But as most of us here know, that doesn't really, it's not really the answer. And so we are trying to to solve this environmental catastrophe purely on the physical plane, which is missing the whole point, which is actually, you know, it is trying to solve the problem in the same way that the problem has been created, which is cutting everything off from its sacred source, cutting everything off from its root. So it's very, very important. Now, what is very beautiful is that and I've looked at this very carefully, is this transition or transformation does not have to be done on a mass collective consciousness level. My feeling is that the collective consciousness in the West, and it is now a global West, the whole world has become McDonaldized, is caught in this dream, in this nightmare of consumerism. And when I looked at it, the energy to take the whole collective out of that dream now would be phenomenal. There would have to become some mega disaster or something, or an enormous influx of grace, or, you know, I don't know what. But traditionally, in the past, changes that happened always happened just within small groups. They never happened on the collective level. Just as interestingly, when a change happens within you, when you wake up to something, it is usually a little spark within you. It's something, a small part of you shifts, and suddenly there is light. Something changes. Part of our kind of Western spiritual childishness is that we think when that illumination happens, our whole life is going to change. And we get really disappointed to wake up and find we still have the same problems with our partner or whatever. We don't realize that you have to work with that light, you have to nurture that light, you have to bring that light into your life. And it can take, that initial awakening can take 20 years to change your life, if you're lucky. So, it is, if we can just bring that presence, that divine being that is the earth, that is the soul of creation, if we can just bring her back, then we create a space where the light can come in, where that presence can come back into her world. And it is just really accepting, first of all, accepting this mystery within creation. It's not something very complicated, just as your own soul is not something very complicated. And you know that moment when you allow your own soul into your life, that moment when you say yes to this inner part of you, and just to take that the next step, and to first of all acknowledge that the world is a sacred being. I mean, I always find it strange that somehow we are very keen on working with ourselves as a sacred being, but we don't realize that this sacred being that is ourselves is part of a much bigger sacred being that is the world, that is creation. And human beings have a very pivotal role to play. For example, until human beings welcome them in, certain angels and devas are not allowed to participate directly in our life. They are there. Sometimes one can see them waiting. Very, very beautiful, very powerful nature devas, earth devas, and angels. And they are waiting on the sidelines. And they are waiting while we kind of tear up the world, because they need to be welcomed in. This is the, in a way, the earth was given to humanity. It was given to humanity to work with, so we could evolve together, so we could have this relationship between the light of our soul and the light of creation, this alchemical interaction of light upon light. And that was always what life was about, for thousands and thousands of years. That's what the mystery of creation was about. It wasn't about, I mean, what is interesting is that we look back at civilizations like the Egyptians and we see these pyramids, or we see other sacred buildings, and we don't understand the real meaning behind them. They were used to bring that light, to focus that light, to focus those energies, so the priests or the initiates could work with them. So that the lights from above and the lights that come from creation could work together. And some, in Egypt, they did it through building these pyramids. In this country, they didn't build any buildings. They had other ways of working, the sun dance. Or, for example, with the Hopi, with the serpent dance, of weaving the energies together, the energies within creation and the energies that are part of a human being. And there are certain words, very powerful words, that are only given to initiates, that are spoken at certain times, that speak to the soul of the world, that speak to the magic in creation, certain incantations that begin to awaken the energies in the earth. Because that's what human beings were about. They weren't about going to Walmart and getting more stuff. The whole of life was about making that creative relationship, that spiritual relationship with the... Yes, there was survival. And there was often famine, and there was sickness. But underneath, there was always a relationship to this divine intelligence within creation. But then, if you like, man got in the West got given too much power. And rather than working with nature, he decided to control nature. And he developed technologies to control nature, whether to build a house that was completely insulated or to make chemicals to make the plants grow quicker. He wanted to control nature. In the moment, this is really the masculine power drive, to control the feminine. And part of that controlling, which was done from the very, very beginning, is you deny the sacred. In the same way as the Catholic Church denied the sacred within women. I mean, how many women were burnt as witches that understood healing, that understood plants, that were midwives? You deny the sacred, and then you have power over it. It goes together. And so what is interesting is we're trying to heal, to redeem this ecological crisis with the same tools of oppression rather than going back to what caused it. Which means that for each of us to take the spark of our own soul and make this relationship again with the spark of the world soul. It's very simple. Spiritual things are very, very simple. But the world soul is still alive. If the world soul had died, or humanity had completely cut itself off from the world soul, humanity would start to regress. It's actually, you see a few signs of it, that when you completely cut off your own soul, you go back to a previous era of evolution. You go back to more primitive behavior. You are drawn back more into the instinctual world of, which is very destructive, that aspect of the instinctual world. So if we had completely cut off the world soul, if we had killed her, then a certain life on this planet would be over. It would continue on a purely physical level. But a certain magic within creation would be gone. A certain spiritual meaning in life would no longer be accessible to us. And you can actually see that because for many, many people, there is no longer any spiritual meaning in life. And as I say, we have substituted that for what we can get at the malls or our addictions and everything like that. Life is no longer seen as an expression of the divine. If that covers everything, then the world is over. It cannot regenerate itself. In the same way as a human being cannot regenerate herself without the energy of her soul, without the divine within. So really, the first step is to acknowledge that the world is a spiritual being. Just as you acknowledge yourself, you are a spiritual being. And then there is this mysterious relationship between the individual and the world, which is what has traditionally been known as macrocosm and microcosm. That we are the microcosm of the whole. Every human being, there is a whole tradition in Sufism about it, which has to do with the perfect man. There is in creation, at any one time, there is one human being who lives the real potential of what it means to be a human being. The Sufis call him the Qutb, the pole. There's only one human being alive on the planet at any one time who lives the real potential of what it means to be a human being. And he carries that for the whole world. He carries that truth, that potential for the whole of creation. If he wasn't here, creation could not rise up to that. It's a very important principle in Sufism. But for each of us, we are each of us in our own way, the microcosm of the whole. And what that means is we each have a direct relationship to the powers within creation. And please remember, and I go back to this because, you know, we read in history about the burning of the books, how the library at Alexandria that contains so many of the esoteric traditions for thousands of years before, hundreds of years before, I don't know, were lost, were destroyed, were burnt. We hear what happened in Tibet with the Chinese, how they systematically burnt the libraries of the Tibetans. And there are enormous amounts of esoteric teachings that have been lost because the Tibetans did an extraordinary work to do with magic, to do with the powers in creation, to do with all of that thing. It's incredible what they did. Most of their teachings have been lost. And in the West, the Catholic Church got rid of this tradition very, very systematically. The Inquisition did part of it, and it was very, very systematic, of this power within creation, of how to work with it. The Gnostics, and some of them understood it in the Gnostic teachings. It has been so systematically erased from our consciousness. For example, I have a friend who recently went to India, and she went to, near to Dharamsala, there's a place called Tashijong, which is a little town, because we have a friend there who is a nun, Tenzin Palmo. She was a Western woman from England, actually, who went and met her teacher in India, who was a Tibetan teacher, and actually did, I think, 12 years in a cave. Who actually did the proper training in the cave, and she's now made a little nunnery there in the hills in Tashijong. And also in those hills, people have been meditating. You know, you get given a little hut and you go there for 15 years. And they have been doing that for hundreds of years. And my friend, when she was there, she was amazed because the hills were alive. She'd never realized what it is actually to experience it when the land is alive, when the land is singing, when you can feel the magic in the air, when you can feel the devas that are present. You know, it is like, for us, it is like a myth. It is like an ancient story. It happened somewhere else. But there, people have been doing practices that welcome the sacred in the land. So there is this relationship. So the land is alive. And that is the soul of the world that is full of all of this magic, all of this creative potential, that is waiting for us to relate to it, to welcome it back. And what is interesting is at the moment of crisis, there is always a moment of potential. There is always, it is like the gates of grace are open in a way they were not open before. It is a strange thing, both in a human being, when they reach a real crisis, they are given a certain grace they are not otherwise given. And it's also for the world. And there is this grace, this energy to awaken the soul of the world before we kill everything, before everything is forgotten, before everything is buried so deeply under the Walmarts of the world until there is nothing left. Then the world will die. It's as simple as that, because it cannot live without its soul. Or the soul will express its dark side, like the Kali side or the feminine, and become incredibly destructive. And that is a very real possibility. Because just as we have forgotten the world is a living being, part of that is we have forgotten the powers of creation that can get angry. This is kind of, again, this myth of control of the masculine that says we can control nature. And it's also said that nature just is not really alive, so nothing too bad can happen. And this is not so. And this is why in ancient times, the people were very careful in their relationship to nature and the spirits of nature, and to talk to nature, and to be present within nature. and how to listen to it, how to make a relationship, a living relationship. Now, it's really difficult now because you go out, you know, on the freeways and the shopping malls and the TV channels, and it isn't there. There isn't even a memory of it. And how to bring it alive, how to recreate that relationship with the anima mundi, with the soul of the world, with this living presence in creation. And my sense is it has to be done through simple things. Because this is, in a way, you always go back to what is simple. It is like when Mother Teresa said, small things with great love. It's not what you do, but the love you put in the doing. And there is a way to be, in a way, to do the simple acts of life. Making a meal, even just having a bath, with a certain awareness, with a certain relationship with what you are actually doing. Remember, it used to be prescribed. We have forgotten that. Bathing used to be a ritual. Cooking used to be a ritual. The women did it together. Like even when they used to pound the grain together, and they used to sing when they pounded the grail, and they sang the songs of creation when they pounded the grail, the grain. It was all part of this very elaborate relationship between the energies in creation. And we can't go back. We can't pound the grain anymore. And we've forgotten the chants and the prayers that went with a ritual bath. Nobody's here to teach us to do it anymore. They have been lost. And so we have to discover it each for ourselves in our own way. What those simple acts we do that in a way welcome the anima mundi, welcome her soul, welcome her presence, and back to us. And then slowly we will have a relationship with her. First of all, you have to welcome her in those simple acts, because we still have to eat, we still have to wash, we still have to breathe. We don't have to go into the fields anymore. We don't have to do the songs of planting and the songs of harvesting and the songs of grinding corn. We don't do them. You can't. You know, we tried in the 60s to go back to doing that, but it didn't work very well. But there are the basic things of life, and always return to what is basic in life, what is simple in life. And it doesn't have to be, it is not to do with time. Everybody is very busy nowadays, I know, but, you know, you still brush your teeth. Are you really present in that experience? So it is like the first step to give a space. And I think it is easiest to give her a space, as I say, in those simple, very necessary things to do with just being a human being you have to do. As Sufis, we also do it in just an awareness of breath, like many spiritual powers. If you're really aware of the breath is extraordinary, because every breath you take, the energy comes down from the soul into creation and back to the soul. If you were really aware of what happens in every cycle of your breath, you would be a liberated human being. Every breath, you would come from the plane of the soul, from the clear light beyond this world, down, and you would bring that energy down into the physical world, into the magic of creation, where that light nourished and communicated to and was communicated to by your own body, by the cells in your body, by the way the light flows in your body, and then went back with that information back to the plane of the soul. It's extraordinary. The simple, that's why we do a zikr with the breath, or you do a mantra with the breath, to bring that consciousness. It is amazing. Every breath you take, the soul, the light of the soul, comes down into this plane, and it speaks to this plane, and it gathers information from this plane, it has experiences in this plane, and it relates to the light in your body, and there is this extraordinary meeting of the light of your own soul and the light within your body. And then it goes back. And that's why, if you were really aware, at the end of every in-breath, which is when the in-breath, the soul goes back to its own plane, there is this moment of bliss. Soul goes back to its own plane. It's back in the plane of the soul. Just for a moment, there is this moment of bliss at the end of every breath. Moment of bliss. It's beautiful. And then it comes back again into creation. So if you do a spiritual practice, that is the light of your nature coming into creation, coming into this world where it interacts with this world. So it's always, you always return to simple things. To make a relationship with God, you return to simple things. To what you cannot live without. It's always interesting as a spiritual practice to, you know, to see what you can live without. Because in the West, we tend to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. Not just things, we also accumulate ideas, we accumulate things we think are important, and then you go back to what is basic. And it's there in what is basic that is life. And life is this incredible sacred light, sacred energy, sacred substance. And it is waiting to be infused with the light of human consciousness. This is alchemy. This is the catalytic relationship in alchemy. This is part of the secret that the alchemists understood. The secret of creation, the way that the light of human consciousness is the catalyst for creation. Now, nobody knows what effect a catalyst can have because we have forgotten about it. We see it in chemistry, yes, but we do not realize the secret of the alchemists, that that belonged to the whole of creation. That creation can also is also waiting to be catalyzed. It is waiting for this spark to go into it so it can wake up. It's as simple as that. So the creation can wake up. That is the secret of alchemy. Releasing the light hidden in nature. Not just the divine light of God in heaven, but the lumen naturae, the light in nature. That is the presence of God in this world. There's a lovely line by the English mystical poet Gerald Manley Hopkins when he says, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil." You know, if you get a piece of foil and you shake it in the sun or in the light comes out. That's the light of the divine in this world. Waiting to come out, waiting to be... Because the worst thing would happen is if it happened and nobody noticed it. We are here to experience the divine in creation. They say you cannot know God in his pure essence. You can't. Would destroy you. You cannot. No one knows God but God. So the Sufis say, but you can know him in his creation. But not in some abstract sense, but in a very lived relationship to this spark in the world, which is really, again, we have forgotten, that is the divine intelligence within creation that creates creation. It is the divine intelligence within creation. In the medieval time, in the Gothic time, they tried to understand what are the divine ordering principles within creation. That's the magic of sacred geometry, of divine proportion. They tried to look, what are the divine principles within creation? And behind those principles, there is the spark, the divine spark, the light within matter, this divine energy of creation itself. It's very, very potent, very powerful. It can change the world. We cannot. We don't know how to do it. We don't know what to do. I I always go back. I was brought up in the, as a child in the Christian faith, and we used to read the Lord's Prayer every day. And there's this line in the Lord's Prayer that stays with me now more and more and more. May thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It is like to give the divine permission to live in creation again. And again, it was got rid of because the church chose political and worldly power rather than spiritual power. That's why I wrote a couple of years ago, I wrote this book, Spiritual Power, because I realized we have forgotten the real meaning of spiritual power. We have even forgotten that spiritual power exists. The Cathars had it, and they were killed quite ruthlessly so that nobody would know. And in the Reformation, they didn't want to acknowledge that at all either. You can work with the individual soul, but you can't work with the soul of creation. You can't work with the primal powers of creation. That is where the magic is. That is where the power is. That is where the potency is. I always say, if you have a problem, you go to the boss. You know what? You know on those helplines when you've got a computer problem or something, the first thing you do is say, can I speak to a supervisor? Then you have a chance of getting a result. Because the guy who you first talk to usually doesn't know very much and doesn't have any authority to do anything either. So we have a problem. The world is dying. Right? It is not supposed to be this. It's like I'm convinced that human beings, because I know what we really are somewhere, are not meant to sit looking at a flickering screen 10 hours a day pressing buttons. Human beings are so extraordinary. They are full of light. They have this intelligence. They are meant to live in a sacred way. They are not meant to spend their life looking at a flickering television screen, computer screen. It's not what we were created for. And there are these powers within creation waiting to be woken up. Just as there are certain, on the spiritual path, what you cannot take a step really unless certain powers within you are woken up. You can't do it. You can sit there doing your prayers, and this is what, again, some of that remained in the Orthodox Church. They kept some of the esoteric practices that woke up those energies. And of course, they were in the whole chakra system in India. And they're also in Sufism, in the Naqshbandi tradition. We have all these lataif, these chambers of the heart, that you work with to awaken certain energies. It's one of also the esoteric reasons of why at some point you need a teacher who can wake up those energies within you. You can't change yourself without them. You can't change yourself on the level of the mind. You can't even change yourself with good intentions. It's like I always felt it was really, really tough on, once the Catholic Church decided to become celibate and everybody had to go off to a monastery, had to be celibate, but they never gave them the practices to transmute their sexuality. It was a real shame. Because I've been a monk in the past life in Tibet, and, when you're a young guy, you get given the practices. In fact, my sheikh, Baisab, he pointed out to, they call him I think brahmacharin, which is when somebody is given those practices at the right age. And he said they have a little bump on the top of the head where the energy has gone to. There are basic practices how to transmute your sexuality. And if you've decided to follow that path, you take them. They belong to humanity, They belong to the magical side of being a human being, how to work with those energies. You can't do anything without them. You cannot progress. That's why you do it on the path. You do a zikr, you do a mantra, you do breathing exercises. They are designed to awaken certain energies within you. On our particular path, we do a heart meditation that spins the heart chakra. that takes you somewhere else to a different level of reality. It's a science, you know, it works. It's how a human being is actually meant to work. And the same for this body called the earth, this being called the earth, this divine presence that we live in. It is meant to transform. At this moment in time, it is meant to transform. I'm not the only person that says that. There's even this Mayan prophecy that if we hang around till the year 2012, we're going to wake up in a different world. You know, it's the end of time, it's the beginning of time. Maybe something's going to happen. There are these signs that the world is waiting to transform. Just as on an individual, there are signs in an individual when they're waiting to transform. They begin to get certain dreams. Certain shifts begin to take place. They are waiting to transform, just like there are signs in a caterpillar when it's waiting to become a cocoon, when it's waiting to become a butterfly. And those signs are visible in the world now. And they're not just in the crisis. I personally think this global communication, the internet, is one of the signs of the world waiting to transform, waiting to shift into a level of different level of consciousness. I'm completely convinced. It's a very tricky business when this shift happens and transformation happens. And an individual, if you're not careful, you can go crazy. When I was 23 and my sheikh woke me up on the plane of the soul, I mean, it took me 9 months to come back again. It's a very delicate time. And that's why when you're really going to transform inside yourself, you have to, often the energies get drawn inward. Jung used this alchemical term called brooding. The energies go within. You don't have the same energy you had to go out and do things, which is difficult in this very extrovert culture that's called America. The energy takes you in. You have to be much more attentive to signs, to how things are. And exactly the same is now in the world. There are signs. And many of us have seen those signs. I wrote about it years ago when I said the magical unicorns that used to be deep in the forest and now can now be seen on street corners. I had it for myself on a very kind of banal level when I was once, a year ago, I was driving on the freeway through Berkeley in the Bay Area, and suddenly I saw this billboard on which was written my favorite Zen koan of all time. The wild geese do not intend to cast their reflection. The water has no mind to receive their image. And it was there on a billboard by the freeway. I mean, what can be more of a sign than that? Something wanted to wake up. And what is interesting is that, you know, most people are far too busy. This is just the accepted thing today. Everybody is far too busy. They I don't know what they're busy doing, but they are busy. It is kind of American addiction. You've got to be busy. It is like Americans are persecuted by time. You know, they're a bit like the people at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. You know, in Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, and it's always 4 o'clock, and they're sitting around the tea, so they don't have time to wash the dishes, because it's always 4 o'clock, and they just move the places around the table, is what we do now. We just move the places around the tea table. And you know, Alice said, you know, to the Mad Hatter, you know, what's happened? And he said, well, I said one day I was going to kill time. So time died. We have this bizarre relationship to time. It's a kind of infantile relationship to time. It's very strange. But what I'm trying to say, apart from that, is that there is a real opportunity for those who are actually awake. Most of the time, being awake is really, really dismal, because all you get to do is see other people snore. You know, I generally don't advise being awake. There's actually somebody years ago in our group had a dream which clearly said that. In the dream, she was asleep in bed, and she woke up before dawn so she could pull the curtains so that when the sun came up, it wouldn't wake her up, so she could go back to bed. I don't know if you've ever, well, this generation yet. Okay, when you were in your early 20s and you were the only person at a party who wasn't stoned? Do you remember how boring it was? Everybody was sort of seeing things and grooving to the music. And, you know, in those days, there weren't designated drivers or anything. So it was really boring. You had nothing to do. You know, it's like being at a kind of sale and not wanting to buy anything. You don't know what's going on. So generally, I don't advise people to be awake because it's just really, really depressing. It's just, seriously, it's, you know. But at this moment in time, it's actually really amazing to be awake, because there are certain things that are going to happen that if you're there when they're happening, you can take part in them. It's like if you are attentive to the world's soul, she is going to let you work with her like you've never been able to work with her. She is going to tell you how to help her wake up. It's like being invited to, you know, to a friend's birth. It's really, really amazing. A few years ago, I thought, wouldn't it be great if everybody woke up? But I realized that was impossible. So I just know I want to be there. I actually want to be here now. When the world is wanting to wake up, when the soul of the world is wanting us to work with it. And she's going to tell us what to do because she's been around a lot longer than us. And all of the books have been burnt. Yes, there were some books in Tibet. I remember reading them a long time ago. There were some very ancient books in other libraries. They have gone. And the oral traditions of the Native Americans who understood it, they've gone. You can't go to the elders because they don't know. And you can't find it in books because it isn't written. It's been got rid of. But you can be there when it happens. You don't know exactly when it's going to happen. There are signs, but we don't know how to read the signs. That's part of the catch-22. Because nobody's told us how to read the signs anymore. It is such an adventure to be present with this energy within creation, with the power in creation, with the soul of the world, which is our soul. We are part of it. It's not our mother, because if it's our mother, we remain as children, and we've played the part of children and become delinquent adolescents. And to me, when people talk about co-creation, which is a kind of popular word now, this is what I call co-creation, working directly with the energy of creation, being present. And, you know, the first thing you have to do is show up. And it's amazing how few people even show up into their own lives. You'd be surprised. They live other people's lives, or they forget they have a life, or it's amazing. So you have to show up into your life, and you have to show up into the life of the world. And the life of the world is not a shopping mall, and the life of the world is not a problem, and it's not going to be solved by economists or scientists, because it's not made like that. It is not a computer-generated model. Just like you're not a computer-generated model. You're not a statistic. It is always this relationship of microcosm and macrocosm, that spark that goes from your consciousness, your heart, to the heart of the world. It is so simple, it is so primary, just as everything in spiritual life is primary. Just as what happens, for example, it's called awakening, the Sufis call it tauba, the turning of the heart, that moment in the human incarnation when you're given this spark. It's an act of grace, and suddenly your whole life changes. Just a spark is put into you. It's very beautiful how it is done. It comes from the higher self. At a particular moment in your incarnation, the higher self is allowed to give you a certain energy. And that spark, that scintilla, that spark, that divine infusion of divine energy, you can call it grace, you are not the same person after that. Something in you wakes up. There is this light, there is this hope, there is this sunshine in the eyes. It's incredibly beautiful, most precious moment. I know when it happened to me when I was 16 and suddenly the whole world was there, like it had always been and I'd never seen it, full of light, full of beauty. And all you have to do is to be present and to say yes. To be present in your life and in the life of the world. The life of the world as it belongs to the soul of the world. And she is alive. She is here now. He is. Because we have forgotten about her for so long. And she's waiting to wake up. She's waiting to wake up.